Buddha famously said, "Ihe pasiko."
That's what you can translate. You're sitting there like we're all going to go, "Oh, that's really profound."
You know what I mean? It's Yiddish.
Sometimes you notice just
there's a correction that gets made in you. You just settle back, and there's peace momentarily. Until you think, that's not it, that's too easy. I thought I was joking before, it's like we have one last one, go. And then I felt bad, I was like, I shouldn't do that. You already have enough of that condition. I shouldn't have to exacerbate it. But the nice thing is that when you're sitting with someone, there's this feedback happening, so you have a natural intelligence, so the learning just starts to happen from putting yourself in the fire. It's like, you know, you just start to learn. Right? This also gets tiring.
Whoa.
I'm using leaning back as a metaphor for pushing away. I'll just stay like this. Try staying like this for half an hour. Unless you have like really great abs. Even if you have great abs, you'd be very tired. I don't know, is that abs that does that? Maybe. I don't know enough about it. I think partly. So you notice, right? And you sit in pushing things away, it's like, oh, I don't want to feel that, I don't want to do that, I don't want to be restless, I'll just concentrate more. I don't want to be sleepy, I'll just, And it gets tiring at some point. I remember at various points, it's sort of like total chaos in here, and I'm trying to make it all orderly, trying to get rid of the chaos. And sometimes you say, oh, this is chaos. Have you ever had it? Did you have a moment like that? Oh, this is just chaos. And all of a sudden, it's totally fine. It's not orderly, but it's just chaos. It's relating to it. The way we're in relationship to it that determines the suffering or the freedom. The chaos kind of has nothing to do with you unless you make it have something to do with you. It's just chaos. I don't know if you can feel that. When I talk about it, I can feel it. It's like, or it's confused. And you've been in that place where it's confused and you're like, I'll figure it out. Pros, cons, I will make it unconfused. I feel tense just talking about it. Yeah. And then there's no one who's like, oh, this is confused. It's confused. And you stop trying to make it different. And then there's clarity right there. There's a much more basic kind of clarity. It doesn't mean you know what to do, but it means you're clear. This is confused. A great place not to make a decision, no. It's like, oh, it's confused. And it will be confused until it's not. You might be able to do some things to affect those conditions, but so this is, well, this is one thing that we're starting to see. Yeah. We start to learn about the nature of our own experience, like the things I was mentioning, right? All those things about pleasant and unpleasant. Did anybody notice that while you're sitting? Just the automatic relationship between pleasant, it's like unpleasant. You know? And then what we do with that in the mind, how we build a sense of self, everything. We're like incredible self-builders. You know? What's your occupation? I'm a builder. What do you build? Identities. What are your materials? Whatever's happening. I can make a house out of anything. I know there should be. Is there a reality show like that? There should be. Like MacGyver for houses. You know, you say, build a house. Build an identity out of anything. Somebody looks at you funny, you make an identity out of it. Somebody doesn't look at you funny, you make an identity out of it. And then you're feeling good, you make an identity out of it. You're feeling bad, you make an identity out of it. You're succeeding, you make an identity out of it. You're failing, you make an identity out of it. It's always about me. And so, this is a traditional metaphor, by the way, as much as it may not sound like one. Right? The Buddha, in these moments where people get enlightened, like wake up fully in the texts, there's a refrain they say, the old you have been seen. And then when I paraphrase the last part, because I can't remember exactly, something like, your ridgepole has been broken. And then there's some more structural comments. And then you will build the house no longer. So seeing this process of identity building again and again and again. And as we start to see it, and start to realize, oh, it's just fear. Oh, it's just throbbing. And there's a natural letting go of this kind of nonsensical, which is another way of saying deluded, thing we do, which is building identities out of momentary experience. And it's like you, we're building houses without foundations, way in the sky, or like just there's no nothing to build that kind of house on because the phenomenon is momentary. When we're not building an identity, things are what they are still. It's not like a different content. It's just, oh, I don't build an identity out of the thought I happen to be having. Oh, I'm judging everyone here. Judging. Not, I'm such a judgmental jerk. Everybody here is a Buddhist. Everybody here is meditating. They're all loving each other. And here I am, judging everybody. What's wrong with me? So we're building an identity out of being a judger. We're making a judger where there isn't. There's just a judgment, right? There's a conditioned phenomenon that builds an identity. There's a the ironic part of judging the judging. Right? But yeah, you know, it's so different. Then you're free to have whatever experience because it's not about you. Yeah, it's yours to attend to. It's not like you're angry. You're like, it's not about me. But it's like, oh, to be with the anger is just another state that comes and goes. Just like nature has all kinds of weather, all kinds of climates, right? Do you think you're an exception? But we take each one of these things, me, and this is the core of the Buddhist teaching. I, me, and mine. Not identifying with experience and making it I, me, and mine when it's not. You know, Joseph, one of my earlier teachers, used to have this physical way of describing. He said, we walk around the world like this. Like, everything that happens is funneled right into me. Hey there. Or, right? That's how I was like, yeah. And then he said, there's a shift in practices, there's a shift to being more like this. Yeah. It's actually not a perfect gestural thing, but, you know, so it's just like, things are what they are. Right? Or, you know, Ajahn Chah, great times, used to say, you see a boulder in the path, you can walk around it, you don't have to pick it up and carry it. You know, but how many things that arise in ourselves do we just pick up and like, let's take a walk with this one? You know, I'll just carry this around with me. Maybe this is why in Zen they talk about these moments of awakening coming. Putting your burden down. You know, put down your burden, these things that you're carrying. So much we carry is me. And put it down. So it's not that you should be able to put it down, but this kind of clear seeing allows us to see what's actual. Right? You can see the process of building identity, and that starts to free us from it. We can't believe in them so wholeheartedly. I know this is a Dharma center because I went over there to get tea and I saw that on the little box that has Splenda in it. the sign. Have you seen that?
Fake sugar.
It says fake sugar. That's like, so this is good. It's a good sign. It's about seeing things the way they are. Right? You never see them anywhere else. Fake sugar. I'll have some fake sugar, please. I guess the next step is having real sugar. But anyway, so like it's good to see what the fake sugar is, at least label it. So somebody asked me earlier something about what's the difference between aspiration and clinging? What is it to us? Because it's this weird thing we're practicing being here with what is it. So what's the place for aspiration? I think there's a place for aspiration is very important. And it's a wonderful aspiration, the aspiration to be free. To have that sense that it's possible, even the hint of the possibility that it might be possible to wake up, to not be bound, so bound entirely by our stories about ourselves or about the world. I think that's a very powerful aspiration, having that aspiration. And you all do, because you wouldn't spend 2 days doing something so difficult on a beautiful weekend if you didn't have that. You may label it in some other way, right? We all have our own way of saying and framing it, but there's some thing active in you that's very powerful, and that's something that's worth nurturing. And yet let your aspiration point you to the present. So we're holding this aspiration, and yet let that inspire you to engage in the practice, which is a practice of here and now Dharma. And that's also from the I forget the Yiddish or not, but that's also in the Pali. Here in this Dhamma is here and now Dhamma. So we have to hold both aspiration and then, but the aspiration is inactive and engaged here. And the unfolding happens here, more like this than like that. Japanese poet, Zen master, and wild man, Ryokan, a beautiful poem. It was like this: Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't think anything but this. If you point your car north, when you want to go south, how will you arrive? Buddha is your mind and the way goes nowhere. Don't think anything but this. If you point your car north when you want to go south, how will you arrive? Even Ryokan's poem is imperfect. Because we don't want to south or north. But the point is made. If you want to, it's more like standing at the target and shooting the arrow away from it. That's pointing the card north if you want to go south. So if we want to wake up here and now, to be here now, not yet here now, later. So this is the path, is always this, and yet there is an unfolding that happens. It does, otherwise none of us would be here, including me. Yeah. So he said to me, this actually doesn't do anything for you. You were being here for no purpose. There's no one. I'd be at the beach. It does unfold, and yet it unfolds for you by being here with what is supported by, of course, stability that we're cultivating here and now. Okay. Oh, it's sort of paradoxical territory in a way. We have to be comfortable with paradox if we're going to be in the domain of the unconditioned. Because awareness is capable of holding both sides of polarity. Right? It transcends opposites. As I said the other day, awareness can watch you get very, very sleepy and yet not be asleep. Anger can be known in awareness. And the awareness isn't angry. It's interesting. That anger is angry. So this is something where we're not pointing the cart north or south. We're including. Sometimes at the end of a retreat, people wonder, well, how am I going to bring this back into my life? You know, how am I going to integrate this? You know, even if you've been practicing long. And what I want to invite you into is that bring your life into this. Let this awareness be your home. And let your life, everything comes into it, right? You hear, everything's appearing in awareness. And outside, guess what? Same thing. Everything's appearing in awareness all the time. We say inside and outside, you know, that's helpful on a relative level. But what's arising inside of you is arising in awareness, isn't it? And what's happening outside of you is also arising in awareness. So this inside-outside thing is, it's important so you don't take somebody else's offering. Right? And you don't go touching people when they don't want to be touched. Right? It's like, yeah, this is the inside, this is me, and that's you. That's very useful. And yet from the standpoint of awareness, this is all happening in awareness, including this body, and these bodies, and all of this is happening here. And that's true here, that's true out there, I'm walking around this area, which I really like about mine. And, you know, at home, you walk into your house and you're, you know, don't expect people to be happy to see you after, and appreciate all the hard work you've done. You know, it's like you basically have been on vacation. I've learned this over time. What's that?
I've heard this from other
Dharma teachers. Yeah. So, you know. But whatever that is that's coming towards you, whether it's on the street or in your home or whatever, that is arising in awareness. Nothing is outside of it. I made this comment about the common denominator of all experience being awareness. And it is. Otherwise, the term experience doesn't make any sense. There's nothing, it's not experience if it's outside of your awareness. Okay? So this is an undiscovered treasure, this awareness. I don't recognize that this, you know, that the Buddha is you. Your radiant awareness is what they talk about when they talk about the Buddha. actually doesn't even really obstruct it. It can't be obstructed in a way. It's just that we're believing ourselves to be all these little things that we're not. So we don't actually gain anything from practice, but we kind of relax into what we are. I think that's good news. What's already here. So even the idea that you're broken or that you don't have radiant awareness is an idea arising in awareness. Checkmate. Can you see that as an object arising in awareness? So I'm telling you this is true. But the Buddha said, who is much wiser than me, ihe pasika. Come and see. Come and see for yourself. Been practicing insight meditation and a lot of other different kinds of meditation for probably over 40 years said to me that for him now the whole practice has come down to two things, awareness and learning. I think that's a nice kind of a modest way of talking about it. When there's awareness present, this lucid awareness, we're learning, and that learning is liberating. Little by little, sometimes in big moments, but awareness and learning. Right? When there's no awareness, when there's no lucid awareness, there's very little learning. We can do the same, you know, we can eat the same fake sugar over and over again and think it's real. Yeah. We can do the same thing over and over again and learn very little from it. Have the same patterns arise again and again. And have them change very little. And yet when there's awareness, it's a different game. And the learning just happens. And it happens, you know, like, we don't tend not to get kind of liberated all at once. You know, there's this path that's always here and now that we walk. And it unfolds at the pace of nature, and not under a timetable. And we're such an instant gratification culture that that can be hard. And you know, we're sort of like, all right, already. I signed up for my enlightenment. It's already Sunday. You know, I'm joking about it, but it's also very real. You know, we don't, maybe not by Sunday, but we have this idea. It's like, oh, it's been a few years already. But it's very helpful to let go of that mind, of that attitude. And you know, as they say in some traditions, not forget the 10,000 year view. What's that? Wait, what? Sounds like a long time. But paradoxically, again, when we let go of,
on Friday, I asked you for a metaphor.
Mm-hmm. And one came to me during my long bike rides back home, which is that thoughts are like food. And I find this useful for understanding our human predicament, that we overindulge a lot and we're really seduced and enticed with that. It just helps me. And I want to thank you for something you said yesterday, which gives me motivation to make good effort, which was that when we think less, better thoughts arise. And I was wondering if you could talk more about that.
I think I said that we're not in our habitual kind of thinking. There's room for another kind of thinking to arise. And so, you know, probably all of you notice this sometimes when you're still, right, the mind gets a little quiet. You have like a different kind of thought, you know, and that's not the point of meditating. But it's kind of interesting to notice, right? It's like, oh. Sort of like, sometimes insights even come in the form of thoughts, right? You realize something, you have a thought. And so that's basically what I meant, is that we have, there's tremendous wisdom in you. I don't even know where it actually comes from. But I think my experience that is in everybody. And it's just that we interfere with it by being in just the most surface aspect of what we are, which tends to be a lot of very habitual, repetitive, and linear kind of thinking. And, you know, there's so many stories about, you know, when do people have their, first of all, they work hard. So it's not like, you know, sometimes you can misread these stories like some, you know, these scientists who are working on a problem and then they come, the answer comes to them in the shower, you know, when they're not like straining. But if they weren't working hard for all those years, it wouldn't have come to them in the shower. It's not like, I better take more showers. Maybe I'll solve the climate change situation. Taking showers would not help solve. But I think there's something in that, there's something in the relaxing of attention that allows things to come together in ways that are beyond what we can do intentionally. Okay? So that's all I meant. And so yeah, a quiet mind is like your best friend, in my view. And quiet doesn't mean like there's no thoughts. Rajan Chah says, as you practice, your mind becomes like a clear forest pool. And then many, you know, he lived in a forest. Clear forest pool, many wonderful animals, wonderful, rare and amazing animals will come to drink at this pool. I think that's true. And we tend to really underestimate ourselves. That's a conclusion I've come to. We totally underestimate how deep we are and how much richness and wisdom is in us. And it's because we haven't had access to the well. This is one way of gaining a little access to the well. Again, that's not liberation per se. But it's pretty good. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit less in that kind of linking part of the mind. But linear thinking can be very useful. I always say it's like it's a great servant and a terrible master. Right? To be able to like plan something out or sit down and say like, oh, we'll do this, this, and this. You know, we couldn't do anything without that. So it's not that that's wrong. What's problematic is that it takes over as like our only mode, and then we're applying it in all these places where it doesn't work and it doesn't fit. It's not actually the best thing. So with awareness, we can free ourselves from that habitual encasement in that. So I think like encased thinking. Right? And then things get very rigid and very repetitive and quite boring and unalive. Because there is a way in which that's not life. Right? I mean, it is manifestation, but it's not. No. It's like if you are really focused on your idea of somebody, you can't see them. You can't really connect, because it's like they're just an idea. And if you ever, sometimes this is why probably famous people have so much dukkha around. You know, it's like, people aren't seeing them. Okay, you may not have empathy for the famous people, but I've met a few, and you can just tell, it's like, because it even happens in my mind. You know, they're like, it's hard not to see the story, you know. But I almost really suck. You know? We do this with each other all the time, but sometimes we have a really rigid story about people. You know, it's just like all this information that's not really about them. Or it is kind of, but so again, that's the way we can encase them our concepts. And people have been discovering over the last, like, usually we're in that moment, like that's a chair, that's a cushion, you know, that's you, and I already know it. And then it's just, it's not that wide. Well, we can let that go. It's like even a chair can become very radiant. It's not that the chair is radiant, it's the awareness is radiant naturally. It's luminous. So everything is illuminated and luminous. And it's because it's all appearing awareness. So sometimes you can get, that's why sometimes practicing this way, things start to feel very sacred. And are outside of that encased, overly conceptual mind. You know, it's just sort of like, even this walk around this area, you know, so like, you tell, it's just, but it's like, you know, how feel like everywhere you step, it's like, it's just luminous, it's sacred. And that's kind of, you know, the mystics throughout this, the generations have been in touch with this in a way. You know, it's like, it's not located in some other place or someplace. This is not, you know, it's like those, you know, Zen says, a dog had a Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. Like, what about this glass? You know, that story of Nasruddin. You know, Nasruddin is like a Sufi fool, wise fool. And there are all these stories about him. In other countries, as in Persia, they call him Nasruddin, and in other countries, they call him other things. But story about Nasruddin is like in the temple, the mosque, and he's got his feet up on boots in there. He's wearing his boots, they're kind of all some holy thing. And Sadhu says to Nasruddin, he says, hey, Nasruddin, it's like a holy place, you can't put your feet there. And he says, where do you want me to put them? So he was some kind of lucid awareness. And where do you want me to put them? Should I explain that? Okay. So any other questions, comments? It's been very inspiring to be with you all. And, you know, like I'm your guest visiting here, but it feels really, I don't know, I felt you all this weekend. It was very inspiring. Moving, like, even just from our interactions, really feel the kind of genuineness of your inquiry. And I love that. It's you know, makes me feel optimistic about things, you know. And I just want to encourage you to keep going, you know. Just keep going. And forever. See you next year. appearing, maybe you'll be appearing in awareness. As awareness next year. How did you get here? How did